So this is Charlie Dawson, co-author of The Customer Copernicus, How to Be Customer-Led. And you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where every Friday I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book. This show has been named one of the top marketing podcasts by Forbes and LinkedIn, amongst others, and has millions of downloads and listeners in over 185 countries. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since I get to read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, connect and message me on LinkedIn, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. All right, let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome Charlie Dawson to talk about the book he has co-authored with Sean Meehan, The Customer Copernicus, How to Be Customer-Led, published by Routledge. Charlie Dawson is the founder of The Foundation, a London-based consultancy established in 1999 to help organizations become customer-led to generate more decisive and sustained commercial success. He started his career in advertising. And interesting fact, he earned an engineering degree from the University of Cambridge. Charlie, congratulations on The Customer Copernicus, and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you very much. I think you might have overdone it on the interesting fact or the interestingness of it, but I appreciate the warm welcome.
But Cambridge is very interesting to me. It is also the alma mater of Sir Isaac Newton, most famously known for formulating the laws of motion and universal gravitation, which we will discuss in a few moments.
Okay.
And Cambridge is also the alma mater of King Charles III.
I am your king.
But probably greatest interest to me, the University of Cambridge is the alma mater of the British actor and comedian Sacha Baron Cohen.
Respect.
But back to your engineering degree, I'm always surprised at the number of authors of marketing and sales books I've interviewed who have engineering degrees. So you're in good company, and I like to say that's further evidence that marketing has gone from madmen to mathmen.
It was also evidence of the number of people that did engineering but don't like it very much.
Well, that, yes, perhaps. But also, that might explain the number of former lawyers who have written marketing and sales books, because it's my understanding, at least in the United States, more than half of law school graduates are not practicing law. And there's a lot of what I like to say recovering or escaped lawyers who have written marketing and sales books, and now they're very, very happy. But speaking of math men, I should also note that your co-author, Sean Meehan, is a certified public accountant.
He is.
Yeah. He also has a PhD in marketing from London Business School, if I'm not mistaken. And he was a marketing director at Deloitte.
That is correct. And I met him when he was doing his London Business School PhD.
Yeah. And he's currently a marketing professor at IMD in Lausanne, Switzerland.
Ricola.
Now, I met you thanks to your colleague, John Sills, author of The Human Experience, How to Make Life Better for Your Customers and Create a More Successful Organization, which was featured on episode 446 of the Marketing Book Podcast way back in 2023. John quoted your book in his book, and at the end of the interview I had with him, I asked if his book was better than yours, and he diplomatically dodged the question. He then, however, sent me a copy of your book with a note that said, as promised, here's the better book by The Foundation. So, he's got your back, as we like to say. Well, I was really interested in his book and meeting him, and he's an Arsenal fan. And which team is it you're a fan of?
I'm a fan of Crystal Palace.
Did someone say Crystal Palace?
I'm feeling
now, you're the founder of your organization, and you're a Crystal Palace fan, and yet you hired John Sills, who is an Arsenal fan. Do your Crystal Palace friends know about this?
I think as a Crystal Palace fan, you get used to the fact that you're going to be surrounded by people that support teams that do better than you. So it just becomes part of a way of life. It's not so good when you play Arsenal in January this year and lose 5-0, but you get good at putting a brave face on it.
But I bet John Sills didn't rub it in, right?
You might lose that bet.
Oh, really? Well, you know, he is an employee of yours, so you could break him in half if you had to. So I have a feeling he's kind of being careful about that.
Okay, enough comedy jokes.
The cover of your book shows a solar system with planets circling around the image of a customer. An interesting fact, I read this book this week while a solar eclipse was happening in North America. So it was all coming together for me, Charlie.
That's good. The heavens are with us.
Yes, yes. So rather than staring at the sun, because of you, I was staring at this book. And now I have my vision is completely intact. So you're helping people in ways you may not even realize. Now, one thing I want to say about your book, after reading hundreds of sales and marketing books, it's become really clear to me, crystal clear, if you will, that companies who put their customers first, in other words, who understand their customers perhaps just a little bit better than their competition, always seem to win. And yet, it is one of the most difficult things for companies to do. And until your book, I haven't really understood why it is so difficult to accomplish that. I've never had it explained like it is in your book. And it's perishable.
Yes.
So I want to quote from page 5, where you write, "Whereas today we take the solar system as a given, Nicholas Copernicus' thesis that the Earth and the other planets orbited the sun, rather than it all being centered on the Earth, was met with incredulity. It went against not just popular belief, but also the church. Such was the scale of this issue that he diplomatically dedicated the book he had written to set out his ideas to Pope Paul III. And he also added a note that acknowledged the book's theory was unusual and proposed that if it helped astronomers with their calculations, then it perhaps did not matter whether the theory behind it was really true. When and whether a customer-led outside-in belief system will ever decisively replace the prevailing inside-out shareholder-first set of beliefs is impossible to know. Our aim, though, in publishing The Customer Copernicus is to support this movement, embracing this Copernican shift, and taking the conversation up another step. We want to show how to create a truly customer-led business, a business that sees the customer as central and itself on the periphery from the customer's perspective. We explain why this is a good perspective to hold, what the pitfalls are with adopting it, and how to avoid them. Creating and maintaining outside-in beliefs is a significant challenge because the default is the opposite. To be guided by what we call inside-out beliefs mean putting the classic metrics like sales growth, market share, and profitability of the business first, prioritizing hitting sales targets, and obsessing over short-term profitability as the driving motivation. And then on page 8, you write that the customer Copernicus set out to answer two big connected questions. And the first is that given that customer-led success can be extremely rewarding and tends to look obvious in case studies, why is it so rarely achieved? And number two, once a company does manage this unusual feat, why doesn't that success last forever? And then finally, you write, when we say customer-led, we don't mean just asking customers what they want and then doing it. And you go on to write that in your research, you saw two competing belief systems, which I've touched on already, that are pivotal to answering your question about the rarity and fleetingness of success. Inside-out beliefs and outside-in beliefs. So to start, explain those two gravitational forces which are so central to your book.
Sure thing. So I guess the idea of looking from the inside out or the outside in is trying to describe people in organizations and the way they see the world. So normally the natural thing in any organization is to be next to your colleagues all day and with customers being distant and quiet. And when you look from the inside out like that, you tend to focus on your colleagues and what matters to your colleagues and what matters to your organization, and that's what comes first. It's a bit of a mental effort to look at the world from the outside in, to imagine what it looks like where the way a customer's seeing it, to really empathize with them and the whole view of the world that they have and the tiny part that you and your organization plays in their life. And that first observation about perspectives is one of the clues about why this is difficult. But then the belief system point, I guess, starts explaining why whole organizations find this even more difficult to do than you might first imagine. So inside-out beliefs, a bit like inside-out perspectives, are natural. And the beliefs that really make a difference to people's behavior in an organization are the beliefs about what success is assumed to be and how you assume success is achieved in that organization. And inside-out beliefs, if you massively sort of simplify, broadly assume that success is some version of hitting the numbers, and that a good way of achieving that is to set higher targets for people and promise them rewards if they hit those targets, and to push them in some way or get annoyed with them if they miss those targets. And what I've just described is, first of all, extremely common. Most organizations do a version of what I've just said. And secondly, if you start in a degree of chaos and you do what I've just described, for a while you do better because people are clear and they're focused and they get on with things and they deliver and you start making progress. The problem with inside-out beliefs is that as the number that you're trying to hit maybe gets higher every year, then at some point it becomes quite hard to hit in the ways that you've always done things. But if you're quite an inside-out believing organization where hitting the numbers is the thing that you're held to, then your response to that tends to be to push harder. And pushing harder at best looks like, you know, becoming quite promotional, trying to sell a little bit more than naturally you're able to. Worse than that is quite hard salesy. So you think of all these sectors that have salespeople that won't let you go, that are trying to really make you buy things that you don't want. And worse than that, people make things up in the organization. They make stuff up in order to make it look like they're hitting their targets. And there have been some big crises and some very public failures where that's happened. But it's just easier to make the numbers up than it is to tell the boss you can't hit the number that they would love you to hit. Outside in beliefs are, almost for an equal and opposite reason, difficult to have. So outside in or customer-led initiatives pretty much always have the same qualities. You can see an idea that would make things better for your customers, maybe making queues shorter in a supermarket by employing some more people in the checkout. So definitely a good idea for customers. It comes with a very definite cost for those extra people, but you're not sure what the commercial benefit is going to be for doing it. Are customers going to come more often? Are they going to buy more every time they come? Or are they just going to smile, be pleased, and do exactly the same thing otherwise that they did before? In which case, you've just added a load of money to your bottom line. Sorry, to your top line, and have taken a load of money off your bottom line. And it's also quite hard to work out in advance what's going to happen when you do that. You can't just ask customers what they're going to do because they can't give you an accurate answer. They have to experience it themselves multiple times. You can do things like piloting ideas, clearly, but by doing that, you show your competitors what you're thinking of doing. And the big advantage you can get from these kind of ideas is to do them first and do them big. So you're left with really having this situation where you can see this better thing for customers, you can see the costs, but you can't make a case in advance that your colleagues are going to really be able to have as a concrete promise. And so most organizations, if they have inside-out beliefs, which most of them do, just don't buy into the suggestion to do something like that.
Yes, and that brings to mind, I believe it was the Tesco case study, where aren't they the ones who did the additional checkout lines if somebody was having to wait for...
Precisely.
Yeah.
Yeah, they called it the one in front queuing promise. So if there was a queue that had more than one person in front of you as the customer, they would open the next checkout. And if they carried on being queues of two or more people, they would open the next one. And they'd keep doing it until they were all open. And they worked out in 1994 that this would cost them £60 million a year. And the profits at the time were only £500 million a year. So more than 10% of their profits were at risk from doing this.
But the thing about that is, and you talk about throughout the book, is there's a risk. And I think so often businesses forget that they're in the business of risk, where they'll say, I want to know exactly what the ROI is going to be of adding those additional checkout people at the grocery store. And so as a result, they don't make the decision, whereas Tesco rolled the dice and did it and succeeded because they were so focused on their customers. So on page 10... Tell us about the research you all did for this book with over 400 CEOs and executive team members of large companies on how they view the drivers of performance in their companies. And this is, I guess, is in light of what action they take.
Yeah. I mean, essentially, we were trying to ask the same kind of thing in two different ways. So first of all, we asked what, in their opinion, from a list of factors, quite a long list of factors, what, in their opinion, made the most difference to business performance? And they were allowed to choose three. And the factor that came top was to do with customers having customer insight and responding to what it was that customers wanted. We also described, we asked a similar question in a different way by describing four types of organization, one of which was genuinely customer-led, and three of which were some combination of either listening to what customers did but not responding, or being quite good at sort of doing things but not listening so carefully, or actually not doing either thing, and just asked which of these four archetypes is your organization most like. And whilst we'd found that the that about two-thirds of people put customer at the top of the factors that mattered, only about a quarter of organizations described themselves as actually behaving in that way. And I guess what this did is it just mirrored what I think we'd experienced anecdotally for years, which is that a lot of organizations claim to do this kind of thing and say that this kind of thing matters, and a whole lot fewer actually do it for real.
Oh, yes. Just a couple of quotes from your first chapter. You write, there's often a disconnect between the great degree to which businesses believe they are in touch with customers and their customers' experiences in reality. And the customer-first literature has influenced the climate for what is said, but it has not penetrated far into what is done. And I see what you did there. And also, another important point here. Being customer-led isn't simply about being nice to customers. It's about making the business tangibly better for customers. So on, let's see, page 19, you write that burning desire that leads a business to become customer-led, to take the first risky steps through the early moments of belief, is hard to maintain. Explain the concept of moments of belief, which is another central part of your book.
Yeah. So I guess what we learned in writing this book, I'll just go back a couple of steps, because the book, writing the book, took 7.5 years, which is ridiculous. And we had no idea, I had no idea it would take anything like that long at the beginning. And one of the reasons it took so long is that for the first year or two, we thought, Sean and I thought we knew a lot of the answers to these questions. And we kind of wrote lists of things, you know, lists of the characteristics of customer-led companies and lists of what customer-led leaders did. And I just sort of realized that I wasn't really convinced by our list. Why were our lists better than anyone else's lists? And then I was lucky enough to be introduced to Tim Mason, who had been at Tesco for 30 years, and he'd become deputy CEO before he was fired in 2012 as the wheels came off in no uncertain terms. And I was really pleased to meet him, and he was quite frustrated with what had happened at the end. And he was thinking about writing a book about Tesco, but he seemed to be the sort of person that was more of a talky sort of person than a writey sort of person. So I said, how about we get in a room and you tell me all about your 30 years at Tesco, and I'll write it all down, and then we can both use what we've got written. So we agreed to do that, and we spent 10 hours as we year by year went through what had happened and so on. And I realized the picture that he painted was really quite rich and complex and nuanced. And what we then realized is we needed to listen to more stories like that from people that had really done this kind of thing. So there are 18 different stories in the book. There were more than 30 that we listened to. And our job then became listening to those stories, writing them up, but then trying to find the patterns that would find commonality that explained the answer to these questions. And the thing that we really weren't expecting to find was the thing that we did find that matters most, which is this thing that the shared beliefs that we have as people the unspoken shared beliefs are really, really powerful, and they determine the way we behave, and they determine what we say, and that's why the Copernicus thing was so powerful that you referred to earlier. You know, when everyone believes the Earth is flat, if you suggest it's round, it's a dangerous thing to do. You might get killed. And in the end, the only thing that persuades people to change their mind around something like that is seeing something for real that contradicts the assumptions that you had, and you can't argue. So when Magellan in the early 1500s got 230 or so people together and three ships and set off and sailed off in one direction around the world and reappeared from the other direction, it was clear that that actually the Earth was round or spherical, and you could no longer argue. I mean, it did cost quite a lot. So it was only 18 people came back, only one ship came back, and Magellan didn't come back. He died on the way. But nonetheless, it proved that it was true. And a moment of belief is our way of describing something real that happens where those, in our case, in an organization, can see that not just when they do this customer-led initiative are customers happy, not just does it cost what you thought it would cost, but that a few months down the line or a year or two down the line, it turns out it does produce a positive, profitable commercial return for the organization. And so your belief that it is possible to do it at least once goes up, and your interest in doing a second thing like that grows. And then you do a second thing like that, and when that also works commercially, you do a third thing, and then a fourth thing, and then a fifth thing. And it is this succession of moments of belief where you keep on demonstrating that when you act in customers' interests, it turns out to be in your interests as well. That's the only powerful enough to change the beliefs in the organization. And once the beliefs in the organization have changed, then basically, you're getting patted on the back for doing this kind of thing. You're getting promoted for doing this kind of thing. People talk about doing this thing as the first thing in the big meetings, not the last thing in the big meetings. It's clear that the organization as a whole believes this is now how it succeeds. But getting from not believing to believing is essentially only achieved through a succession of moments of belief. It is not achieved by telling great stories on their own or by great oratory or anything like that. It is the more sleeves rolled up practicality of showing that this stuff can work that gets you through.
So an example of that would have been what Tesco did with their checkout line?
Absolutely. So they did do it, and it did take a number of months to be able to see what effect it had on the business commercially, but it turned out it was a profitable idea, and they'd done it ahead of their competitors, and their main motivation was to get ahead of their competitors, and they were encouraged to do a second thing. In fact, they had a list of 200 issues that customers had with the shopping experience, and they'd started with the one that they thought was the most likely to work, and so they went to the second on the list, and they did the second on the list, which was backpacking, which cost £15 million a year to have enough colleagues to help customers with that, and that worked, and then you do the third thing, and just like I described. So yeah, exactly that. That was Tesco's first moment of belief where they began really to build confidence on this part of their journey.
And I like how you describe it as a satellite circling, like let's say the Earth, where it has to have fuel to stay aloft outside the gravitational pull. And if they don't continue to have these moments of belief, it starts to fall back down. And you write that if the customer-led rise is tough, which we've established, avoiding the fall is tougher. So now that everyone's thoroughly discouraged, no, I'm kidding. But on chapter 33, you write, I think it's 33.
Possibly page 33, because there are only six chapters. So,
Did I say chapter 33?
Yes.
Yes.
But that's fine. You're just assuming that we wrote written more than we did.
Thank you for your attention to detail. See, that engineering degree comes in helpful. You write, like a satellite that achieves escape velocity to go into orbit around a planet, a business can propel itself into taking an outside-in perspective. But as the years go by, momentum fades and gravity brings the satellite or the company's belief system right back down to Earth. Let's go back, though. Do you have other examples of companies that were able to escape the gravity of inside-out beliefs?
Yes. I wonder whether we ought to also just mention the role of burningness.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Because that's that there are sort of two things, two components that really allow organizations to lift off. And the burningness, in a sense, comes first, actually, before the moments of belief.
Mm-hmm.
Because what we found was that, in the normal run of events, if you were trying to make a case for the thing like the one in front queuing promise, you just wouldn't get agreement. So burningness is a slightly odd sounding word.
It sounds
describes pain.
Personally painful. Yeah, I think it's perfect.
Yeah, well, I guess at least there is one positive version of it. So it describes one of three things, or a combination of three things: pain, fear, or ambition.
But that order is very important.
It is. It is. So pain is probably the most effective. So pain is basically it's going wrong. It's like a turnaround situation in an organization. It's urgent. We've got to act. We've got to change. There's no argument about whether we change. The only argument might be about the direction that we go in. Fear is less effective because with fear, it's fine now, but there's a threat. So maybe you're a conventional organization that's non-digital, and there are
like
digital
Kodak
competitors
film.
Coming.
Yeah,
like Kodak Film, like TV companies that ran TV channels before the streamers came along, and you can see there's something coming, and their model looks much less attractive than the thing that you've got. You've probably honed your thing to be quite profitable and to be doing quite well, and theirs looks a bit disruptive and maybe not profitable at the moment. So why would you voluntarily ruin your business today? So the problem with fear is that you wait. Maybe you get into action to try and do a bit of sort of exploratory R&D and innovation, but the risk is you just don't act on it sharply enough. And then ambition is sort of in theory the weakest, because as far as you can tell, it's fine now and it's fine in the future. But as a leadership team, you really want to achieve something or prove something or maybe fix something out there in a purposeful kind of way, or maybe just win. Maybe you just have a real competitive kind of instinct. And the point about burningness is to have the effect that it needs to have. Whatever one or combination of those factors that I just described you have, it needs to be non-negotiable that you're going to do something about it. And if it's non-negotiable that you're going to do something about this threat, or that you're really serious about this ambition to win, then doing what you've always done is pretty much the only way to guarantee you're not going to deal with the burningness. You're not going to realize the ambition. You're not going to deal with the fear. You're not going to tackle the pain. So it flips the risk around. So now only doing something quite different to what you've always done has the chance of dealing with the thing that you're looking at. And whilst it doesn't necessarily mean that you'll bet the entire business, it does mean that the idea of taking an initiative that has some risk attached is worth doing. In a sense, what you're doing is you're saying, well, we've got to do something, so let's choose the least risky of the risky things and try that, rather than being rooted to the spot and never trying anything. And so burningness, and we drew an analogy, and we said that this thing about the belief systems is a little bit like, if you imagine a planet, and the organization is a planet. This is a slightly odd Copernican metaphor, but the organization is like a planet. Customers are, for some reason, floating in space, and customers can see many planets, and they've got lots of choice. People that serve customers for the organization are on the surface of the planet, so they usually have a pretty good idea about what matters to customers. But the people leading the organization are right at the heart of the planet, at the core of the planet, literally looking from the inside outwards, with layers of planet kind of in the way between them and customers. And then if you add the idea of gravity, so if you're a little startup planet and you're the leader, actually a bit like being on the moon, it's not so hard to jump up and to escape gravity, at least for a little bit, and see things the way customers see them. But the bigger and more complicated the organization gets, the stronger the pull of inside-out gravity is. The more layers of organization you've got, the more stakeholders you've got, the more likely regulators are there to produce rules that you've got to engage with. The owners want to know stuff. You've got to report earnings on a quarterly basis, maybe. all the stuff that is anything but customers is incredibly noisy, and customers carry on being quiet, quietly making their choices. So the gravity is enormous. So then what we said is what we learned about burning this and moments of belief, and there are a couple of other steps in the journey as well. Effectively, this is like putting a satellite up into orbit, as you described, Douglas. So the burning this is like lighting the rocket motor. The moments of belief are like the stages of the rocket. And then the third step is becoming systematic. So you sort of lock on to the right trajectory for you to be in orbit. And then being purposeful is like these bursts of energy to try and stay up. But the point about this gravity is that, like satellites, when you leave a satellite up for long enough, there's a little bit of friction up there. And the reason that satellites gradually fall back to Earth, and we occasionally have worries about satellite debris and so on, is that if you just do nothing, you don't stay there. And we felt this was a very helpful analogy, because it is like that with organizations too. And I guess if you think about the success that you have, it makes you bigger. It makes you more complicated. It risks taking the leaders further away from customers rather than nearer. And so the very consequences of doing well make it harder to keep on track.
I just loved the analogy you use in the book, and it really stuck in my marketing brain. And in the weirdest way, to use a different one, it reminded me of the story about how when the Roman leader would come back from a successful campaign, there would always be a slave on the chariot with them, reminding them that it's fleeting.
Yes. Lovely. Yeah. Yeah, I've heard that. I've heard about that. And yeah, absolutely. Because otherwise you get in your own little bubble.
Oh, yeah. The gravity takes hold. And I can't imagine anyone other than a CEO or a leadership team that should be the most concerned about this gravitational pull. And it's also very seductive. In other words, you feel busy. You feel like you're doing things. You're taking care of things.
Yeah. And if you've been successful, people keep giving you awards and telling you you're brilliant. And, you know, that hardly engenders a sort of mindset of paranoia of sort of realizing you need to keep on being on edge, because otherwise this is not going to last. It becomes very comfortable.
You start believing all your PR. Become high on your own supply. Well, let's jump ahead. I want to talk about something that just I really want to grab every marketer's lapels and shake them and help them understand how much this can help them. This isn't necessarily what you wrote in the point in the book, but it's really, really helpful. And I've seen so many marketers be successful when this happens. It has to do, I'm on page 56, where you talk about customer-led leadership. And I want to quote from this and then ask you to expand on it, if you would. And again, for the marketers out there, or salespeople, or anyone, listen to this and think about how you might be able to do it, even if you're not the CEO. You're writing about Martin Glenn, who was with Walker's Chips.
Yes. Owned by PepsiCo. Yeah.
Okay. And at Chips, Crisps, there's a little bit of translation I had to do when I read the book because of, you know, we're a united people divided by a common language. So you write that Glenn's transition from marketing specialist to CEO generalist is one clue to the way the marketing mindset became central to the company's ways of working. This meant the whole business naturally started with customers, and the marketing function was not seen as a pressure group, but as the voice of the customer. We saw a similar phenomenon at Tesco when Terry Leahy was marketing director and made a point of stepping forward and becoming the voice of the customer for the business. According to Leahy, he said, "It's hard to argue with what the customer is saying, and if you can bring that into the boardroom, it's a very powerful tool. All I had was the voice of the customer and made my argument to the decision makers on their behalf, which proved to be incredibly powerful in terms of persuading colleagues how the business needed to change." In my ad career, I can remember, I never remember clients ever being quieter than when we would play video that we had captured out on the street with a camera talking to customers. It was just amazing. And just to continue this, there was a listener in New Zealand several years ago who'd been listening to the show for a long time, and he had worked in marketing and he wanted to get back into marketing. And he contacted me and said, "Hey, I've been listening to your show. I've been learning a lot. And I'm actually applying for this job." And I said, "Great, that's good. That's good to hear." And so after a while, he contacted me and said, "Hey, I got the job." I got that marketing job. And I said, that's terrific. And then, like a lot of listeners, he said, well, can you recommend a book? And a lot of folks, you know, if I can help listeners not have to read 500 sales and marketing books to recommend one or two that'll help right now, please let me do that for you. So he said, is there a book you could recommend for so I could learn more about our products? And it was a business-to-business, kind of a high-tech, I think the water filtration or something, a lot of engineering. And he said, is there a book that I could read about to learn more about our products and the nature of what we do? And I said, oh boy, that one I don't know. I'm sure there are, and you should know about your products, but why don't you think about becoming the customer expert? And I recommended a book to him at the time called Buyer Personas. And so we left it at that. I sent him a link to that interview. And after a few months, he contacted me and said, holy smokes, it worked. I went off and did what they said in the book, which was really just, you know, trying to find these five insights about customers. And he said, now they don't have meetings without me. And he was like probably the only marketing person. And he said, now this is what was funny. I don't want you to hurt your feelings, Charlie Dawson. But he said, when I'm in a meeting and I'm talking, even the engineers are quiet. And he said, and even the salespeople are quiet. And it worked really, really well. So that's why you can see how this worked. It's so valuable, not just for the CEO, but for organizations to try and dial into what's on their customers' minds, how they can actually help their customers.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, one of the things that I've found useful to have in mind is that revenue only comes from one place, and that's customers. Revenue doesn't come from products or services. Products or services don't make their minds up to buy something. We work with a retailer in the UK that sells clothing and food. You know, jumpers don't buy anything. Lasagna doesn't buy anything. Customers are the only source of revenue you have. So customers, it's a very strong rock to stand on if you're in a business sort of debate, because you've got to understand customers. You've got to keep earning their decisions. Their decisions to do business with you or not do business with you, that's it. That's your lifeline. Everyone else depends on that. Everyone else is a cost in some way. I always keep that in mind as well about why it's so important to start with customers. And then starting with them and their world is the slightly less intuitive thing, perhaps. But that's what starts you off down that path.
And you quoted Peter Drucker, who said the purpose of a business is to create a customer. At the end of the chapter, you have some simple recommendations for being extremely focused in a productive way. And these are just great. And I want to quote from Martin Glennigan, who said, don't confuse sending someone to the front to find out what's going on to going there yourself. I've never regretted a field visit, a factory visit, a supplier visit. You're always learning something. If you would, this is, I guess, another little piece of research, or maybe it was part of the other. Talk about the research you did, which is on page 62, where you asked a large sample of British CEOs how they spent their time.
Yeah. So the how you spend your time thing is, most people find, I guess, that question gets answered by an inside out view of the world. Mm-hmm. I was just describing and trying to bring to life, you know, that all the pressures you have, all the stakeholders you have, the people that report to you, and so on, and spending time with customers or close to customers and seeing for real what really goes on is sadly quite a rare thing for senior managers to do. And I remember a very long time ago, Sean and I was doing some research together on this, and we spoke to one person who said that he spent every Friday in situations where he was talking to customers. And I was like, how on earth do you make time to do that? And he said, well, I took a look at it the other way around. How on earth could I do my job without doing that? I was like, okay, that's interesting. But that's what a belief is. His beliefs and his own belief system is that way round. He can see how crucial it is, so everything else fits around it. Whereas I think the normal thing, the common thing, the inside out way of doing things is to need to respond to all the noise around you. And so you get absorbed by doing that and it just fills up all the time in the week and a bit more. And there's no time left to do these things that you would have to do voluntarily and you'd have to put in yourself and you'd have to really make it happen in quite a determined way. So, yeah, it's not common to spend time in that way. But people that get this kind of thing prioritize it.
There's a story in there, same page, about Brian Cornell, who became Target's CEO. It says he ditched the ceremonial visit process, which, you know, when you said that, it reminded me of every time when I was in the Army, a general was going to come visit. So, of course, everything would get painted.
Yeah, yeah.
And all the uniforms would be nice and fresh and pressed, and it was really I think the generals probably knew it wasn't helpful either. But he wrote, he ditched this ceremonial visit process. Instead, he reached out to pals outside the company to put him in touch with a mix of Target shoppers with whom he visited a local store unannounced to management or staff. They gave him what he valued most, a grip on reality. There was no advance notice, no quota of visits, no specific schedule, no set visit plan. Instead, there were lots of basic questions. He would absorb reactions and answers, probe for better understanding, learning, and also develop a more vivid, animated, and powerfully informed perspective with which to engage his management colleagues. And he said this is just how he worked. And going down there, he also talked about another CEO, Rupert Soames with the Aggreko.
Yeah.
He said whenever he had a moment, he called up 15 or 20 unhappy customers. Brilliant.
Yeah. Ugh. Yeah. Again, just the belief. His belief was that that's how you learnt the most fundamental outside in things about how your organization's performing, and it will give you all sorts of clues about how you can do better. And in the end, you'll end up succeeding as a business if you know that. But that belief is so obvious when you describe it, but it's so kind of uncommon, and it's such hard work to do it, or maybe persuade people to do it if they're not used to doing it, if they haven't got that belief themselves.
Well, and that's where I just think there are a lot of smart marketers that are doing that, or that could do that, and they will be amazed. It'll all almost be like their moment of belief when they then present this. And jumping over to page 96 in chapter 3, you have this section that talks about the telltale signs of outside-in versus inside-out belief systems. And I want people to listen to this because, which organization might I be in? And as you said, most companies are inside-out. And I wanted to ask you to talk about some of the telltale signs of both belief systems. And I'll give you the first one here was the company Orange. Under the leadership of Hans Snook in the 1990s, you write that you had to talk about the customer. If you failed to mention customers in the first 5 minutes of a board presentation, you would be asked to stop and leave the boardroom. Love it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And this is all about what an organization does rather than what the organization says. What are the really important meetings that never move, and which ones get moved quite easily? And in those really important meetings, what's the first subject on the agenda and what comes later? Because again, that's what we all know as human beings. We can sniff out what really matters around here, and we know that that's the clue as to that's the real answer. And we kind of look to join in because that's how you get patted on the back and that's how you end up getting promoted. So you look for behavior and routines and that sort of thing. And you don't listen to the fact that maybe at the top of the list of values or something is something saying customer first, if that's not what, and you don't believe it, if what you see is the opposite. Language, actually, I mean, I sort of said, ignore what's said. Language is also a clue. In fact, language is a huge clue as to what the underlying belief systems are. And one of the examples that I most like is just the idea of driving sales is a really inside out idea. Mm-hmm. And a bit of language. Sales are what matter to us, and driving them is pushing. Driving them is doing whatever it takes to make customers buy stuff so that we hit our targets. I mean, driving sales is a really is not a nice idea when you really think about it, but it's very common that people talk about that. And it sounds more convincing in a meeting if you talk about driving sales rather than just growing sales. And so people learn to say the thing that sounds a bit more assertive. Another way of saying the same thing is earning customers' decisions. Earning customers' decisions is an entirely outside-in idea. Mm-hmm. It's customers that are in charge. It's their decisions that determine whether you get any revenue or not, and you have to earn them. They've got choices. You have to be more attractive to them than the alternatives, and if you're not, they're going to make a different decision. So language, that those little bits of language are shorthands to really different belief systems.
Yes, and I had to laugh when I read this one quote I'm going to read from page 96 and 97, but I want people to listen, because if this sounds familiar, you need to rethink things. You write, many companies are organized around and celebrate products. The main functions are product-led. The pictures on the walls are of products, often pristine, without a human to mess up the view. And the main events each year are product launches. Store visits are to check on the store and the staff rather than to listen to and meet customers, finding out what they really think about what's going on. And customer contact means watching focus groups from behind a one-way mirror, eating sandwiches, drinking wine, and laughing when they say something silly. Ooh, I loved it. I loved it.
Yeah, and sadly, and I've experienced it all too many times.
Oh, me too. You know, sitting behind the focus group mirror and then listening to people make fun of things these customers are saying, what a wasted expense. So towards the end, you'll see in chapter 5, you quote Greg Rutherford, the British Olympic gold medalist in the long jump, who said, as a jumper, I try to defy gravity for as long as I can. But no matter how far I jump, I always hit the earth eventually. And in that chapter, you write about the inevitability, like we've talked about, of being pulled back down to earth from the soaring heights of customer-led success, and that, you know, outside-in beliefs are never secure. As I said, they're very perishable. What are successful companies, however, knowing that this doesn't last forever, what are they doing to forestall that inevitable gravitational pull away from being customer-led? In other words, if there are certain surfers who are able to stay on that wave longer. What are the things that companies are able to do to stay in orbit?
Yeah. Well, and thankfully, we found some that had managed to maintain very unusual outside-in belief systems for decades. And I would still assume that even they, it will be temporary, but decades mean that it's survived many generations of management, which I think is one of the big risks.
Yeah, and some of these case studies were just amazing. Some of these are like the 100-year-old bank in Sweden and...
Yeah, Handelsbanken are we switched our bank as the foundation. We switched our bank to Handelsbanken in the process of writing the book because they just sounded like the kind of bank you'd want to be a customer of. Mm-hmm. So they do three things. First of all, they pay attention to their belief system. They don't necessarily use those words, but their culture. I should just add very quickly that we very deliberately have talked about beliefs and belief systems rather than culture, just because it's a bit more precise.
Yes, that was a very interesting point in the book.
Yeah, so I mean, culture is another way of describing what we're talking about, but it feels like it all gets a bit fluffy and woolly. And what we're talking about is whether you believe you do things in the interest of customers and you're going to succeed or not.
Right, and we don't want a fluffy book written by an engineer and a certified public accountant. Thank you.
Well, you're not going to get one anyway. The first thing is they pay attention to the belief system. So their belief system or their culture or whatever is important to them. They talk about it a lot. They worry a lot about whether it is changing gradually away from what it has always been and what they think is important or not.
And let me just interject. Is that related to they only have three levels of management at that bank?
At that bank, in each country, they only have three levels of management.
That's it.
That's right.
And they tried to add a fourth one at one point.
So let's get to that in a second. So the second thing they do is they have a constant flow of moments of belief. So they have things that happen that demonstrate that this slightly odd way we have of doing things around here is the way we do things around here, and it matters. And so what you were just describing, Douglas, is with Handelsbanken, one of the things that happened that reinforced those beliefs was that someone got promoted to be chief exec from the organization. He wasn't an outsider. He got promoted from within. But he then suggested earlier in his tenure that he was going to introduce a fourth decision-making layer to countries, and he got fired. And early in his tenure as a CEO of one of Sweden's biggest banks, it was front page news. And it sent shockwaves around the company. And I was having this story described to me by the chief exec of the UK bit of this bank. And as he said to me, look, honestly, there isn't really any reason why four layers doesn't work and three layers does work. It's not that simplistic. But if you had four layers this year, then why not five next year and six the year after that? And then you've lost it. And so keep holding the line on something slightly arbitrary, but being really strong about it, just showed people that we are not changing principles that relate to our beliefs. We hold those dear. And if you have a different view, you can go and work somewhere else, even if you're the chief exec. So that's the second thing. So talking about the belief system, having a continual flow of moments of belief, they're the first two things. The third thing is by far the hardest. The third thing is being boldest when you're challenged the most. So let's take another step backwards. The definition of being customer-led that we have is, as you said earlier, it's not asking customers what they want and doing what they say. Instead, it is doing two things. It's really understanding what the problems are that customers need to solve or the outcomes they want. And those things tend not to change very much. You know, we need to get from A to B. We need to buy food, you know, good food at affordable prices. We want to look good in our clothing. We want to be entertained in some way, maybe by the television. So being really clear about the problems or the outcomes, and then finding new and better ways to solve those problems or help customers achieve those outcomes. So customers can help you with the first. They can remind you what it is really matters to them, but you have to be inventive to do the second. Now, if you were invented as an organization 25 years ago, you might have developed the best possible solution to a customer's problem, to your customer's problem that's relevant to you, that could possibly be had. But maybe a new bit of technology comes along, and actually that allows an even better solution.
Right. So, Nokia comes to mind, which I think is one of the case studies.
Nokia and Apple come along, or mm-hmm. You're a linear TV channel and a streaming service comes along, and what a customer really wants is to watch what they want to watch, when they want to watch it, and this is just a better solution. And when that happens, it's really awkward for the incumbent, because you once had the best possible answer, you scaled it, so you've built a machine that is really good at doing that thing, and now there's a better machine. And so being boldest when challenged most means spotting it early, mm-hmm. and that's not easy, because sometimes it comes from something that you wouldn't define as your market, because your market might be defined inside out as a load of products rather than outside in as the solution to a bunch of problems that customers have got. So you've got to spot it first, and then you've somehow got to challenge your existing model at massive pain and inconvenience to you to try to come up with an even better solution to the customer's problem than the new one that's threatening you. And I think the really awkward thing about this bit is that I think it's possible that sometimes you might not even be able to come up with a new and better answer. So if you're a telephone network, so for a while, the mobile phone networks were powerful things, powerful brands in a lot of countries. They were very aspirational. And then actually, from their point of view, it wasn't just Nokia that got hurt by Apple. It was these sort of businesses too, because the handset manufacturers and the ecosystems that went with them, like the Android system or the Apple system, that became the dominant force. And actually, if you were a network just in the UK, there's nothing you can do about that. You have to be global. You have to have vastly greater budgets to be able to do what they're doing. what you really need to do is adjust your focus and decide that the problem that you're solving for your customers that you can solve best is maybe a slightly narrower definition than the one you first had, and then concentrate on doing that brilliantly. And maybe that's being, maybe that's the version of being boldest when challenged most in that case. So it isn't necessarily just going head on with a new competitor. It might be needed to adjust your focus a little bit in order to keep on being the best possible solution for customers, and therefore still sustainable and profitable as an organization. But yeah, those are the three things: focusing on your belief system, having a continual flow of moments of belief, and then being boldest when challenged most by a competitor solving a customer's problem better than you can.
Yes, and a very important thing that you just slipped in there, as you said, understanding what problem it is you solve for your customers. It seems like very often companies don't actually understand the problem they're solving.
Yeah.
Which brings to mind all the jobs to be done
literature
and thinking, which is so interesting.
Yes, I agree.
That third is being boldest when most challenged, but it also made me wonder, is it also being bold when you're most comfortable?
Yeah. So that gets us back to burningness. Because when you're in this kind of moment, you're going to need burningness. You're going to need that kind of flipping of the risk. You're going to need to kind of think you're going to have to do something that's not very comfortable again to be the next thing that you do. And the difficulty when you succeeded, maybe you've succeeded brilliantly for 20 years, is that you definitely don't have pain, but you probably don't have fear either, unless you work at it quite a lot, because of this thing that I referred to a bit earlier about you know people giving you awards and telling you you're clever, and you know the profits have been rising at some ridiculous rate for years in a row. So it's quite difficult to be fearful. It feels like you're impregnable.
Right. You need that Roman slave on your chariot after the war.
You need that Roman slave on your chariot, or you need to be. It needs to be self-generated. It needs to come from your own ambition. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, that's the only one that's left of those three sources of burningness that is sort of immune, perhaps, to your position. And just that kind of, I suppose, you know, there are some sort of people, some sort of leaders that are just restless all the time, are always relentlessly challenging, questioning, trying to find a better way, and so on. And I guess in my mind, that's the sort of characteristic that you need to give yourself the best possible chance of keeping on doing this customer-led thing over decades rather than years.
Yes. Well, Charlie, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
I would hope that they take the belief that you really can achieve exceptional business success from what I might describe as generous customer offers and experience, offers that genuinely make it better for customers, and the flip of that being inward looking and driven by numbers is actually ultimately poisonous.
Yes, and I wonder if, you know, in your work and the book you've written, if you make a lot of people uncomfortable when you're giving these presentations, or when they start to realize, wait a minute, that's me. I'm the inside out thinker.
I think, yeah. I mean, I've certainly experienced that as people kind of go, crikey, yeah. I mean, you know, we're just really inside out. But I mean, usually when we're having a conversation with them, it's because something's happened that's made them be interested in the idea of changing it. So yeah, it's usually coupled with a very helpful kind of forward looking direction.
Yes, yes. Well, let's give the listener something to do. What is one thing the listener could do today to put in action an idea from your book to get them thinking in the right direction?
I would say the single most important thing is to go and speak to some customers, or rather go and listen to some customers.
Yes,
and in particular, speak to them outside in. Ask them about their lives and what matters to them more broadly, and then what the areas of their lives are that are relevant to the kind of things you do, and then how they find those areas of their lives and what works well and what works less well. And then maybe some perspective on the kinds of organizations and ways that they found of getting help with those things and the things that get in the way. But having those conversations in person in an outside in way, and just so I'm emphasizing that, because another way of having the conversations is inside out, which is to say, what do you think of us? And if you start with what do you think of us, you're never going to get away from us and just the customer telling you about their expectations of your business and a few little anecdotes about where it's good and where it's bad. You need to have the conversation outside in, start with them and their lives, and then you'll learn a huge amount and you'll see opportunity, not just problems and things that you need to fix.
Oh, that is solid gold advice. And it takes us all the way back to the beginning where you make it clear, don't just ask customers what they want.
And then yes.
Follow up by saying, don't talk to your customers, listen to them. Listen. It's such valuable advice. It's profitable advice. Very, very hard for organizations to do. So looking back, what books have most inspired your working career? And you can leave out the engineering books if you want.
Thank you. I would have left them out anyway. There are probably a couple that I'd mention. So one of them is a book that Sean Meehan co-wrote before he was involved in this. He wrote it with someone called Paddy Barwise, and it's called Simply Better. And the idea in it is that in influenced by marketing, a lot of organizations have tried very hard to become different, and they've lost sight of plainer things that are more central and that really matter to customers. So Volvo has become known as being quite different because it stands for safety, but Toyota has built a whole production system that has made the cars more reliable. And Toyota is many times the size of Volvo. So Simply Better was about work out what really matters to your customers and concentrate on getting better at that. Don't worry about trying to be a niche and being differentiated as the main thing. In our definition, we talk about being new and better. So we are trying to prompt innovative versions of being better. But the fact that we talk about being better is not an accident, and that's inspired by that book.
That's a 2005 book, Harvard Business School Press, Simply Better, Winning and Keeping Customers by Delivering What Matters Most. And you mentioned Paddy Barwise. I always thought of him as Patrick Barwise because he co-authored a book that was on the show several years ago, which I thought was just one of the most powerful books for marketers who want to be successful, The 12 Powers of a Marketing Leader. And I interviewed his co-author, but that was so interesting. It was so, you know, in other words, most of the books on the show are about how to do some aspect of sales or marketing or customer experience better. That's one of the small number of books that was about more specifically how you as a marketer can be more successful. And they used a lot of McKinsey data in the book. So anyway, you're talking to a real marketing book nerd here. So I had to interject. I'm sorry. Yeah, please go back.
I can tell. Okay. And the other one is not a marketing book. It's a book with a very odd title, which is Obliquity. So Obliquity by John Kay.
I saw that at the end of the book here. You mentioned that.
Yeah.
Concept.
So John Kay has got a much more straightforward name than his book has, his book title. So Obliquity is about things in life like profit for a business or happiness for a person that kind of seem from the outside like maybe they can be achieved directly, but actually they need to be achieved obliquely, indirectly. So, and this relates to some of the ideas in the Custom Copernicus.
Yes.
So if you try to maximize happiness as a person by just doing a load of happy making things, maybe you just end up going to the cinema every night or going to the bar every night. And in the end, you feel a bit empty and a bit rubbish. Maybe if you set out to climb a huge mountain, there are aspects of it that you hate that are really difficult, that are really horrendous. But you get to the top when it's really fulfilling in a much deeper way than just doing a bunch of shallow, happy-making things. Profits for an organization or shareholder value for an organization, it's that we've spent a lot of time trying to directly maximize shareholder value or directly grow profits by doing things that directly affect the numbers. And he makes a fantastic case, and he's got some great examples where organizations, in fact, there was one example of ICI, a chemicals business that was international, but it came from the UK. For a long time, they were very successful because broadly what they did is they tried to apply chemistry to human problems and solve the human problems. And then they nearly got taken over in a hostile bid and decided after that they needed to shift their approach. And they made their purpose maximizing shareholder value. And over the next 10 or 15 years, they destroyed more shareholder value than they'd created in the first decades of the company. So he said, it's poisonous. When you try to directly achieve the thing that is the outcome that you think you want, you you actually do things that at best make a short-term difference, positive difference, but are likely to make a long-term long-term damage. And Obliquity is quite a short book, but it's very well written and it's very persuasive. And I think it informed me about the outside in belief system versus the inside out one, because the inside out one is exactly what John Kay is describing being unhelpful. And the outside in one is this less direct way of achieving success through being better for customers first and trusting you're better for the company as a result.
Let me add to or conclude what you're saying here. Well, I'm quoting from page 174 about obliquity. The idea that goals are often best achieved when pursued indirectly or obliquely, which of course brings to mind the Tesco checkout story. According to John Kay, shareholder value or profits are outcomes that indicate success but are unhelpful if pursued directly. Instead, Kay argues, the defining purpose of business is to build good businesses. Kay's idea is that if one builds a good bank, then profits will follow, something demonstrated by Handelsbanken's long run of success.
Yes.
Interesting. Well, are there any recent or upcoming books you recommend or maybe are looking forward to reading?
So I could mention four. I should mention swiftly. So I would also mention John Searle's book in return for his mentioning mine. So The Human Experience. I'm mentioning it just because it forms a set with the other three. So the other three are Glue by John Doerr. So he's someone I know very well. It came out quite recently. This is about leadership in a hybrid world. So when lots of us are working in different places and we're not all in offices together and so on, what is the glue that holds us together? And how can leaders provide that glue? So again, it's about a human take. It's a bit more internally focused, but it's about humanity.
Glue, Transforming Leadership in a Hybrid World, John Doerr. Great.
So third one, Return on Humanity, which is actually only comes out on the 1st of May this year. It's by someone called Philippa White. And Philippa has run a really interesting business for the last 15 or 20 years called TIE, the International Exchange it stands for originally. And what she started off doing was helping leaders in the developed world, in the West, learn to be better leaders by going to the developing world and on their own and helping with a charitable project alongside people in that place and spending 6 weeks doing it. And by being put in that situation, people found they had none of the supports that they normally had, and they had to just trust and rely on the things they learned, and they had to learn a great deal about from the people they were with about how to get anything done in the place they were at. But over those 6 weeks, the first week or two were usually horrendous and really hard and very disconcerting, but people got into it, and they ended up making a huge difference in very unusual ways and learning a huge amount about what leadership, what good leadership really looked like and what getting things done collaboratively really looked like and so on. And from that, she has drawn a whole load of other conclusions about, I guess, what achieving things for people, with people, looks like. And yeah, it's a great book, and and the cover is sort of RO with the I crossed out and humanity written instead. So again, I guess there's a theme to the things that I'm recommending in looking away from just the numbers and towards people as you route through.
Yeah, Return on Humanity, Leadership Lessons from All Corners of the World. Interesting.
That's the one. And then the last one is called, it's got a slightly striking title. It's called The Scavenger Mindset, and it's by Claire Richmond. And Claire is someone that achieved something exceptional in a local community that she lived in, where the high street was dying, and without any permission or any position of authority at all, just as someone that cared about it, she started doing something, and she engaged the local shopkeepers of independent stores who were suffering. And she encouraged them to think a bit about what maybe they could do, because they were all struggling against internet shopping and, you know, big chains and so on. And they ended up creating evening events where they opened their stores up. They offered drinks. They had it was near where I live when she first did it, and my son went and played in a little band in one of the shops, and we saw what was happening. And And it worked, and it created relationships between those shopkeepers and the local community. And the community realized that they valued these stores, and they got to know the shopkeepers. So they went back and they supported them. It gathered momentum. The library got involved. The schools got involved. And then after that, she was asked to do another project that was similar by a local council who gave her a budget. And when she got a budget, it didn't work. Because suddenly everyone's behavior changed and they all wanted a bit of the budget, and they all assumed that the budget holder was the person in power, really. And so her learning was that leading with less rather than more can actually be really helpful. And again, there are a load of human reasons for that she goes on to explore more fully through lots of other examples. But I loved what she did, and she's gone on to be very effective beyond those first two examples. But yeah, The Scavenger Mindset by Claire Richmond is also worth a good read.
The Scavenger Mindset, Rethinking Leadership to Unlock the Untapped Talent Within. Wow, that sounds fascinating. Interesting. At this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com, we'll include links to everything linkable, including all the books that have been mentioned, your site, the book site, your LinkedIn profile. I'll even include John Sills's episode. Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. Absolutely.
It's a great book.
It is. I really enjoyed it, and I enjoyed interviewing him. And now, dear listener, please, please reach out to Charlie and congratulate him on the book. Thank him for being a guest on the Marketing Book Podcast. If nothing else, just share this interview on LinkedIn and tag us so we can thank you, or ask Charlie a question and he'll respond. And if you're listening on your smartphone and you've subscribed to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app like Apple Podcasts, all of these links can be found by going to this episode right now and clicking on this episode's website link. Final quote, page 14. This book explains why so much hot air is wasted eulogizing customers to so little effect. It seeks to demystify customer centricity. It illustrates why so many companies have not backed up their words with effective action in their pursuit of customer-led success. It describes what it takes to become a genuine customer champion and how to sustain it. The book is The Customer Copernicus, How to Be Customer-Led. The authors are Charlie Dawson and Sean Meehan. Charlie, thank you very much for joining us on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you, Douglas. You've been a great host. Really enjoyed it. Really appreciate the time.
Booyaka, Sharon.